Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The fourth annual Paul Buck Memorial Lecture in Plant Biology will take place tomorrow evening on the University of Tulsa campus. Just as researchers are examining our DNA for essential information on how humans evolved, botanists and biologists are examining plant DNA for those same answers to how plants evolved. My guest today is heavily involved in that process. She's one of the researchers that have traced the very first flowering plant, a scrubby flower located on the remote island of New Caledonia. Dr. Pamela Soltis is a curator of the Laboratory of Molecular Systematics and Evolutionary Genetics at the Florida Museum of Natural History, which is a division of the University of Florida, and she also holds a concurrent post at the university. She and her husband, who is a biologist at the university, have researched and published together for many years and have contributed to the use of molecular evidence to reconstruct the patterns of plant evolution. They've contributed significantly to our understanding of the evolution of flowering plants. Pamela Soltis is one of the principal investigators for the Floral Genome Project, which examines that origin, conservation, and diversification of genes involved in floral plants. She's also been instrumental in curating the Plant Branch of the Tree of Life web project. She served as president of the Botanical Society of America and received numerous awards for her research and scientific breakthroughs. She'll be giving the Paul Buck Lecture tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock on the University of Tulsa campus in Helmrick Hall. The lecture is free and open to the public. She'll be speaking on plant conservation in the 21st century. Dr. Soltis, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks a lot for inviting me.
Yeah. I would think botany is an ideal way to see evolution in action. Each season, as springtime comes around, when you're looking at flowering plants, there's always new varieties. You have botanists, amateur flower growers who are creating all sorts of hybrids. I would think that plants' ability to hybridize would say that most plant species can change fairly quickly. What is the sense of the scale of plant evolution? Is it quicker than other species?
I think that there's a good chance that there is a lot more rapid evolution in plants than in maybe some other groups of animals. And I think part of that is, in fact, due to hybridization, as you suggested. Plants do a lot of hybridizing, and often accompanying this hybridization, the plants will basically double their genomes. So after a hybridization event, the plant might have the whole parental genetic material of both of its species combined. And so instead of just having one set of parental copies, it has the copies from the other parent as well. And this sets the plants on their own trajectory because they're no longer able to breed with their parental species because they have twice as much DNA. And we see many, many evidences of this when we look at plants. And the flowering plants do this really, really commonly. Ferns do it really commonly. Mosses do it somewhat. The conifers don't do it very much, but most of the plant groups are hybridized and form these new, what we call polyploid species, really very frequently. And in fact, we found that some plants can have done this and originated new species even within the past 100 years or so. And
well, that was my next question. As you know, you have this double set of DNA. At what point does it become a new species instead of a hybrid?
Well, so some people, and I guess I would probably put myself in this category, basically think that when that hybridization and genome duplication event occurs, then that new derivative is really a new species. It can no longer, in almost all cases, form fertile offspring with its parental species because it has twice the number of genes and chromosomes. And so it's almost an instantaneous form of species formation. Other people might say, well, you know, it might take a little bit longer. You know, we want to see how well they get established before you might call it a new species. But most people really recognize that process as an almost instantaneous
so the ability
for species formation.
The ability to reproduce or not does not matter.
Right, because, and in fact, usually what happens when you get this, what we call polyploidization event, the genome duplication, in most cases, the plants are fertile at that point, but they're fertile only with themselves, with the other plants that were originated from that same source, not with their parent species.
Gotcha.
So they can reproduce with themselves, but not with their parents.
Yeah. Now, you're going to be speaking on plant conservation. Given the fact that plants are susceptible to changing pretty quickly. What is the imperative on plant conservation? Are we worried that we're losing? I mean, I know there's plenty of grants these days for looking at medicinal plants and things because plants are so changeable. I mean, they change really quick. What's the need for plant conservation?
Plant conservation is really important. As you mentioned, you know, there may be many plants that are beneficial for human use, but in fact, of course, they also form the fundamental parts of most of our ecosystems. And so the loss of any species within an ecosystem can have devastating downstream effects. So within any given region, there are undoubtedly many rare species that are in need of conservation. We have an area in central Florida, for example. It's called a ridge. It's hard to imagine that there are hills in Florida, but in fact, there is a ridge. And this is an area that's particularly interesting because it was basically the only part of Florida that was above sea level during bouts of glacial advance and retreat. And so it's become sort of a refugium for a lot of plants and animals. And there are many, many hundreds of rare species there, many of them federally endangered. And so sometimes there's a cluster of rare species like that, and we can concentrate on preserving the habitat. More often, the rare species are more scattered, and it's a little bit more difficult. But, you know, you mentioned hybridization with regard to conservation, and there are some really valuable scientific studies that have demonstrated that in some cases, a widespread plant species might hybridize with a rare species to the point that the rare species becomes almost extinct, or in fact is extinct in terms of its own gene pool. And that sort of situation happens commonly on islands or in areas where there are introduced species. And so because plants are so prone to hybridization, in fact, we have to, in some cases, try to prevent those sorts of hybridizations from taking place in order to preserve the integrity of the species.
What sort of interventions do we do today?
In some cases, if the culprit is an introduced species from somewhere out, you know, and is occurring outside of its native range and is hybridizing with something in the native area, we can work as hard as we can to keep that introduced species out and from becoming established. So there are often groups of, you know, civic groups that focus on trying to reduce invasive plants in a particular area, and sometimes that can help. Yeah. But in a lot of cases, we don't have any control over it, and that becomes really difficult.
One of the things you do at the Florida Museum of Natural History at the University of Florida is you kind of dig into the mysteries of the origins of plants. Why, you know, we've certainly seen the Human Genome Project. We're looking at all sorts of DNA projects. Why is understanding the origin of plants important?
I look at it similarly to understanding human history. We can't necessarily understand ourselves and our place in the world without understanding a bit more about where we've been as a people, as society, as cultures. And so history is really important. And I view our understanding of biodiversity in the same way. We can't really understand the distributions and processes of plants and animals across our planet today if we don't understand where the species groups originated and how they've evolved over long periods of time. So I think getting that historical perspective is really important in a general sense. But there are a lot of more concrete ways that understanding the history of plants, in my particular case, can help us understand things that are maybe more relevant to processes going on today. So, for example, if we were able to reconstruct the whole family tree for all of the flowering plants, and there are maybe 300,000 or 400,000 species of them, we don't even know for sure how many there are. If we could do that, we could then map particular characters across that family tree. So just like you could take your family tree and plot out across that tree, you know, who had blue eyes or brown eyes or various other sorts of traits, we can do the same sort of thing across an evolutionary tree. And that can help us to understand how different types of traits evolve. And it can help us understand what the transition points were between one form and something else. It can also help us kind of focus in. If we're interested in a particular thing like a medicinal compound, we know it's in one plant. Maybe it's more likely that it will be in a related plant than in something randomly selected from across the whole evolutionary tree. And so you can go in and use it for predictive reasons like that as well.
What about contemporary issues like climate change? What would knowing the background and the origins of floral plants or any sort of plant tell us about, you know, how plants dealt with earlier climate changes?
That's a great question. And there are a lot of different ways that botanists are starting to look at that question. One of them has to do with investigating the fossil record. So it's possible to tell in the past by the size and distribution of the stomates, the cells that and the openings that allow for gas exchange in the leaf, by measuring those in fossil plants and comparing them with modern plants, we can sometimes determine what the climates were like in particular times, because plants change those sorts of characteristics relative to carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere. So we can go back and look at, ancient patterns of perhaps CO2 levels and infer what that meant for plant communities from the fossil record. And I don't do that sort of work, but I'm really fascinated by it. And I think it's a really clever way of using what we know from fossils to understand more about climate change. But there are a number of other approaches that people are using as well.
You know, I learned a rudimentary sense of respiration, and I think most of us would say high periods of carbon dioxide is good for plants. Is that always the answer? I mean, that in times of high carbon dioxide concentration, this is good for plant life on our planet?
Probably more or less. I mean, I guess what we see, and there are some studies that have looked at this on a global scale, but not a lot that I'm familiar with, at least. At various times in the history of the Earth, carbon and dioxide levels have been particularly high or particularly low, and there are these vacillations that seem to be correlated in some cases with either bursts of diversification, where lots of new groups have gotten started, or sometimes with major changes in distribution. So it looks like there could be some biological characteristics that may be associated with some of those historical changes.
My guest today is Dr. Pamela Soltis. She's a curator of the Laboratory of Molecular Systematics and Evolutionary Genetics at the Florida Museum of Natural History. I'm smiling because that is a long title. Basically, she researches the origins of plants, and she has also a concurrent post at the University of Florida. Her husband is a member of the Faculty of Biology there, and the two of them actually combine on all their research, and it's, as I was doing some background reading, in fact, you're known as the Solti because you guys really get after it and are really known for the quantity and quality of your work. She'll be delivering the 4th Annual Paul Buck Memorial Lecture in Plant Biology Wednesday at 7 o'clock in Helmer Hall on the TU campus, speaking on plant conservation in the 21st century. Well, let's talk about your specialty, which is flowering plants. Everybody loves flowering plants, angiosperms, if you will. The two of you have been doing a lot of research on flowering plants. In fact, you might have found the earliest flowering ancestor. Is that right?
Well, based on everything that we can find growing today, yeah, we think we've identified the plant group that is what we call the sister group to all of the rest of the flowering plants. So it would represent sort of the Eve metaphor for flowering plants.
Do you have any thoughts or hypothesis on why plants develop flowers in the first place?
Oh, there have been so many hypotheses about that. So the flowering plants, based on the fossil record, got started about 130 million years ago, probably a little bit before that. And their ancestors were other seed plants, such as relatives of the conifers, such as pines and so on. And those seeds that are produced, say, in a pine cone, lack additional protection from the elements or from predators. And so there have been a number of hypotheses about how a flower and the structures that are in the center of the flower, the reproductive structures, have combined to provide a real selective advantage and adaptive advantage for the flowering plants relative to the other seed plants, because the seeds are actually contained within a fruit, and that fruit develops from the central reproductive parts of the flower. So most of the hypotheses basically come back to that point, that the seeds have a lot more protection in a flowering plant than they do in a gymnosperm.
And I assume that gave it a great competitive advantage over over millions of years.
Yeah, so that's definitely the view that, that these hypotheses have put forward. Unfortunately, it's one of those things that you can't really go back and test. So, you know, it's an inferential sort of hypothesis, but certainly consistent with everything we know.
Tell us about this common ancestor. What is this common ancestor? I understand it's a plant that it's like a New Caledonia out in the middle of the South Pacific, right?
Right, yeah. So the plant's name is Amborella, and it's there's just one genus that occupies this position. It's recognized in its own family, but there's really just one species in one genus, and that makes up the family. The plants are shrubs, and they occur in the rainforests on the island of New Caledonia. And we were fortunate enough to visit some populations of Amborella about a year ago, and it was an amazing experience. Because when we first made the discovery of where its historical position is in our evolutionary tree, and we did this with a lot of colleagues, it wasn't just Doug and me, we did it on the basis of a DNA sample that we located in a freezer at the Smithsonian. And so we've been growing plants in our greenhouse, but we hadn't seen them in the wild until about a year ago. So that was an amazing experience to get to go and see them.
Now, I have to tell you, that sounds so counterintuitive that, you know, the common ancestor for flowering plants would be in this remote location. Does that make sense to you?
Well, so New Caledonia is an amazing place. There are many, many, many very unusual plants and animals that occur there. And some of them are thought to be very ancient, like Amborella, and others might not be quite so old. They may have adapted to this island area more recently. But New Caledonia, the history of the island is a bit uncertain, but it seems to have come from the same general landmass that produced Australia and New Zealand. And it's possible that there's sort of a remnant vegetation that's left over from, you know, very, very long periods of time ago from that sort of larger general landmass. But it's really something that we don't know very much about. And so there's a lot of interest now in trying to solve the geology of New Caledonia and try to figure out a little bit more clearly where it came from.
I can understand that there'd be a very diverse plant and animal life just because of its isolation. I mean, we look at what Darwin found in the Galapagos, you know, the same sort of, I think, same sort of issues at play. But the idea that it's the first plant. Now, how did we go about figuring this out? I mean, through DNA genome sequencing, or what exactly?
Yeah, so for about 25 years or so, plant biologists have been able to use some DNA approaches to reconstruct this evolutionary tree, family tree sort of thing for plant groups. And as part of a really large collaboration, we had a paper published in 1993 with 43 authors from all over the world. This was great. Botanists were all interested in this question of how different plant groups were related to each other. And so people just shared their data really freely, and we constructed this first real hypothesis for the family tree, family relationships of the flowering plants. And at that point, Amborella had not been included in any analyses. And so over the course of the next several years, there were a lot of efforts to try to figure out, you know, what other plants needed to be sampled and so on. And so we were doing the sabbatical at the Smithsonian with Elizabeth Zimmer, one of the scientists there, and we started sampling some of the other DNAs that were in the freezer, and we were sequencing just small regions of the genomes, two or three different genes at that point. And we, which was, you know, kind of state of the art at that point in time in the mid-90s. And lo and behold, Amborella started showing up in this unusual position in our trees. And other people started sampling it too with other molecular techniques. And a consensus soon emerged by the end of the 90s that this was the first branch in the whole family tree of flowering plants.
Anything that has changed our, perhaps changed our mind over the last 10 years as far as new samples, new, I know this is one of the things that was really interesting is that one of the things botanists seem to do is they collaborate a lot more. You know, you mentioned 47 names on a paper. That seems to me a little unusual.
Yeah, botanists are really collaborative. There's a tradition, I think, of the, you know, I think of this as like the old, you know, gentlemanly approach to science, which is, you know, it was mostly gentlemen back long ago.
And yes. Amateurs, in the best sense of the word, yes.
Uh-huh. Right, and people were very, very polite and very communicative, and that's translated into the way that a lot of botanists continue to conduct research today. And, I mean, our zoologist friends tell us all the time that they're so jealous of the way that botanists can interact with each other, and they're just more contentious, I guess, than we are.
My guest today is Dr. Pamela Soltis. She is at the Florida Museum of Natural History and Evolutionary Genetics and concurrent post at the University of Florida. She'll be delivering the 4th Annual Paul Buck Memorial Lecture in Plant Biology Wednesday in Hillmerick Hall on the TU campus, speaking on plant conservation in the 21st century. Well, another exciting project you're involved in is the Floral Genome Project. Explain what this is.
The Floral Genome Project really got started from our findings about what the first branches of the flowering plant family tree really were. And by being able to identify amberella and water lilies and a group that includes things like the spice that's called star anise, several people might be familiar
yes.
with that.
Cook
those
with it,
are
yeah.
some, yeah. So those are some of our the very earliest branches in the flowering plant family tree. By understanding what those branches are, that allows us again to try to ask questions about how certain traits, like the flower, originated. So we started working again with a nice group of collaborators at a number of institutions to try to figure out what the genes were that make a flower. And we did this by looking at little snippets of the genomes of flowering plants and some of the seed plant relatives. So we looked at some representatives of conifers and some representatives from cycads, the sago palm, and some of their relatives. And we were looking for genes that were present in flowers that were not present in the reproductive parts of these other non-flowering plants. And over the course of, and that started in 2001, and we started getting lots and lots of information about the different types of genes. It was fascinating work. But technology has totally revolutionized how we go about addressing those questions. And now, just a little over 10 years after we started that project, we've sequenced the entire genome of Amberella, and we now have the whole genome. And we can now use that to start asking those sorts of questions. And we're just in the initial stages of trying to analyze interesting questions from the genome sequence.
Having that complete genome sequence, that means you can say, okay, where did Amberella come from, right?
Right, exactly. So, of course, there aren't that many plant genomes that have been sequenced yet. There are maybe 20 or so total, and most of them are things like crop plants and some of our important horticultural plants as well. So, you know, we're in the early stages of this whole endeavor, but certainly the data will allow us to look at, in a really broad scale, how the flower originated from a genetic perspective.
Well, getting back to your talk in Tulsa on plant conservation, what are the biggest issues surrounding plant conservation in this new century? I would think climate change and ecosystem change would be up there at the top, or is it?
Yes, definitely. I think, you know, climate change is, of course, really, really important. Another thing we have to think about, though, is the expanding human population. And so, just where space for humans will be relative to where natural plants will be is something we need to think a lot about as well. And so knowing that there are these pressures from both changing climate and the human population growth, we really need to focus and prioritize how we go about conservation and management plans for plants and animals and fungi and habitats in general.
All right. Well, tell us a little about the Florida Museum of Natural History. That's where you work. I know you have a whole lab of doctoral candidates and graduate researchers that are investigating all sorts of questions. Give us a sense of the range there.
Yeah, so the museum itself is a really diverse and exciting place to work. We have collections in plants. We have our molecular lab. We have a mammals collection, birds, herpetology, fish, paleobotany, vertebrate paleontology, Lepidoptera, and archaeology and anthropology as well. So we have a really diverse group with lots of graduate students, undergraduates, and about 25 faculty or so, and over 100 staff. So we have a public face to the museum, and then we have a research and collections area and emphasis as well. And that's, of course, the part that I'm a member of. In our lab, we have about 20 people right now, including postdoctoral scientists, graduate students, undergraduates, and they work on all sorts of topics. Several of them work on projects that are closely related to some of the things that we've been talking about now. But a lot of them have their own interests in particular groups of plants. We have a student who's very interested in the mint family and its evolution. We have several students from South America, and most of them are interested in groups that were really important for in conservation and in evolution in their home countries. So we have a student working on this as a really cool group of plants that occurs in the cloud forests of Ecuador, because that's where she's from. And a student who's working on a group of lilies from Chile primarily, although they occur across South America because that's where he's from. So we have lots of exciting stuff going on, and it's it's hard to keep up with everybody, and so it's a great way to learn a lot because they have so many things going on.
Now, I mentioned,
and we all share with each other.
I mentioned your husband, Doug, earlier. I think from a very early age, the two of you have been collaborating on all of your research. Basically, you publish all your articles and all of your research jointly, and I assume you work together jointly. What is that relationship like? I mean, are you guys, do you take one question at a time, or are you working on multiple projects? Or what exactly?
We have several projects going, and we kind of have a hopper of ideas. And as things come up, we kind of take turns being the lead investigator on the one project or another. And so kind of just depends on where we are in that sequence as to which of us is the official lead person. But we work on just about everything together. And it works out great because, our work is also our hobby, and so, it's nice to be able to talk about your work at night and not have to, when it's something exciting, not when it's something that's a drag. I mean, I'm not sure how this would work otherwise. We work a lot, but it's fun, so, we get to share discoveries together and things, too.
All right, well, we look forward to your appearance in Tulsa. Dr. Solsis, thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thanks very much. It's been a pleasure.
Dr. Pamela Soltis is a curator at the Florida Museum of Natural History, one of the principal investigators for the Floral Genome Project. She'll be discussing her work in the 4th Annual Paul Buck Memorial Lecture in Plant Biology tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock in Helmer Hall, speaking on plant conservation in the 21st century. The lecture is free and open to the public. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.